Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the October 7th edition of The New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is, Can Harris Stop Blue-Collar Workers from Defecting to Donald Trump? By AL Press. Letters from Pennsylvania. Can Harris stop blue-collar workers from defecting to Donald Trump? She's touting the Biden administration's strong record on labor, but it might not be enough to win over voters who distrust Democrats as elites, by AL Press. In June 2016, Scott Servich, the president of United Steelworkers Local 2227, a branch based in Western Mifflin, Pennsylvania, drove for half an hour to a union hall in Pittsburgh, where Hillary Clinton was holding a campaign rally. Servich was hoping that Clinton, whom the USW had just endorsed, would talk about jobs and the steel industry. Instead, she focused on the character flaws of Donald Trump, calling him temperamentally unfit and totally unqualified. As Servich listened, he grew frustrated. What did she plan to do for workers? Afterwards, he told me, Clinton shook hands with supporters. Servich stood there in his union shirt, but Clinton didn't extend her hand to him. Hey, Hillary, he called out, prompting her to turn around. I'm the union president. We really need your help. He remembers her saying curtly, oh, I will help, then leaving. That November, Servich voted for Clinton, but this fall he's backing Donald Trump, in part because he believes that Democrats don't actually care about the working class, a group defined by pollsters as people without college degrees. If Servich were still running Local 2227, he might have felt pressure to keep his decision private, since the USW, like most unions, is supporting Kamala Harris. But he left his post in 2022 and is now free to speak his mind. Most of the rank-and-file workers Servich knows share his view, he told me, regardless of what union leaders say publicly. I don't care what you see on TV, he said. The grunts in the lunchroom love Trump. Not long ago, America's steel mills and factories were full of loyal Democrats. These union members understood that, in the struggle between labor and capital, Republicans sided with management. One of the workers who shared this outlook was Servich's father, Herman, a retired steelworker and the person who introduced me to Scott. When Herman was young, he told me, employees knew there wasn't a Republican in the goddamn world that ever tried to help the working guy out. Herman, an 83-year-old who wears a ring inscribed with the USW logo on his right hand, still believes this. He raised his children, 5 sons and a daughter, in a household that he thought would instill the same perspective in them. To his dismay, 3 of his sons support Trump. I don't know where I screwed up, he said with a sigh. The shifting political allegiances of blue-collar voters have made it increasingly difficult for Democrats to compete in, much less carry, parts of the country they once dominated. In 1984, Walter Mondale won 10 counties in western Pennsylvania, home to the state's once thriving steel industry. In 2016, Hillary Clinton lost all but one, contributing to her defeat in Pennsylvania and consequently in the election. Some of the union members who had long turned out for Democrats had either moved away after their factories shut down or became MAGA Republicans. And a new generation of blue-collar voters was emerging, one that was less likely to belong to unions and to vote Democrat. The counties where this transformation occurred are heavily populated by working-class whites, who were especially receptive to Trump's xenophobic nationalism. But some polling suggests that the decline in support for the Democratic Party hasn't been confined to the white working class. In 2012, Barack Obama carried the non-white working class by 67 points, a margin that helped him win the overall working class vote. In the latest Times Siena poll, Harris trailed Trump by 18 points among working class respondents, in part because the size of her advantage among non-white voters without college degrees, 24 points, was roughly a third of Obama's in 2012. Although Black and Latino voters back Harris over Trump by large margins, the Times Siena poll showed Harris with substantially less support from both white and non-white working class voters than Joe Biden had in 2020. The large crowds at Harris's rallies, along with the donations that have poured into her campaign, have drawn comparisons to Obama's electrifying race for the White House in 2008. The broad enthusiasm her candidacy has aroused is reflected in the proliferation of Zoom fundraisers with names like South Asian Women for Harris and White Dudes for Harris. But Harris's support rests disproportionately with affluent college-educated voters. It's possible that courting such Americans, including Republicans in the suburbs who dislike Trump and support abortion rights, will enable her to win. But even if this strategy succeeds, it will raise questions about the Democratic Party's identity and priorities. For much of the past century, its leaders have prided themselves on championing less advantaged people. If such Americans continue drifting away from the Democrats, it will be hard to dismiss the perception that the party speaks mainly for coastal elites and upscale professionals. This is particularly dangerous in Rust Belt states such as Pennsylvania, where this year's election may well be decided and where nearly two-thirds of voters don't have college degrees. One mistake of Hillary Clinton's that Harris will surely not repeat is taking the support of working-class voters for granted. According to Steve Rosenthal, a former political director of the AFL-CIO, the country's largest federation of unions, Clinton didn't visit a single union hall in Michigan or Wisconsin after she became the nominee in 2016. While she dismissed Trump's supporters as a basket of deplorables, Trump held rallies across the Rust Belt promising to bring back jobs and deliver a victory for the wage earner. Trump's speeches were littered with bigoted remarks about Mexicans and Muslims, but as a group of sociologists noted in a paper published in the British Journal of Sociology, he also exalted factory workers who had been stripped of their jobs and of their dignity by cultural forces beyond their control, especially free trade agreements backed by Democrats. Of course, Republicans had supported the same agreements. Trump's message resonated with voters like Steve, a retired firefighter I spoke with while visiting Berks County in southeastern Pennsylvania. He was dressed in a t-shirt adorned with the American flag and told me that he'd voted twice for Bill Clinton. Grandpop was a Democrat, Dad was a Democrat, he explained. They had a pro-union stance and that was that. I learned it from them. Then he watched the North America Free Trade Agreement, which Clinton signed, ripple through the Rust Belt, causing nearby factories to slash jobs. Those places laid off hundreds, sometimes thousands of people, he said. I met Steve, who left the Democratic Party outside a Trump field office, where he'd come to volunteer. Once Trump was in office, he abandoned his vow to help America's forgotten workers. Instead, he cut taxes on the wealthy. Trump appointed Peter Robb, a former management attorney, as general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board, which issued a series of anti-worker rulings, including one that restricted the ability of union organizers to communicate with employees. By contrast, many scholars regard Biden's administration as the most pro-labor since FDR's. In Biden's first year, the NLRB ordered employers to reinstate more workers who had been illegally fired for protected activity, such as participation in a union, than it had during Trump's entire presidency. And the agency has defended workers involved in organizing drives at companies like Amazon and Starbucks. In 2023, Biden walked a picket line in Michigan with striking members of the United Auto Workers, a gesture of solidarity no other sitting president has performed. Harris walked a UAW picket line in Nevada in 2019. Biden also oversaw a boom in domestic manufacturing and construction, which was spurred by legislation, such as the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, that required workers' salaries for government-funded building projects to reflect prevailing wages, thus encouraging the hiring of union labor. Had Biden run again, he undoubtedly would have campaigned on this record, hoping that it would pay dividends with voters in union households, which he won in 2020 by 17 points, more than double Hillary Clinton's margin. Since Harris became the Democratic presidential nominee, she has also tried to emphasize her labor credentials. Among our first campaign stops this summer was a Union Hall in Wayne, Michigan, one of the three locations where the 2023 UAW strike began. She went there with Tim Walz, whose selection as her running mate drew praise from labor leaders familiar with his record as the governor of Minnesota, which includes signing a law granting workers paid family and medical leave. Seven union leaders spoke on the opening night of the Democratic National Convention, among them the UAW's president, Sean Fain, who wore a Trump is a scab t-shirt and told the crowd, "Kamala Harris is one of us." It's not clear, though, whether most workers share this view. A few weeks after Harris replaced Biden on the Democratic ticket, I met Aaron Joseph, an organizer with District Council 57 of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, which has members in 32 counties in western and central Pennsylvania. At a coffee shop in Carnegie, a working-class suburb west of Pittsburgh. On social media, Biden's decision to step aside was greeted with relief and exuberance. Joseph told me that the painters, glaziers, and drywall finishers in his shop reacted differently. "We've been hitting a 3 to 4 year boom because of the administration's policies," he said. "When Biden stepped down, it was like losing a friend." The union had plenty of Trump supporters, Joseph told me, but Biden's vocal backing of organized labor and the fact that he was from Scranton and seemed at ease among blue-collar workers had bolstered his appeal. Harris lacked these advantages. "She's from California. That generally does not play well in western Pennsylvania," Joseph said. "For our membership, there's a sense of unfamiliarity." Celinda Lake, a pollster who has conducted extensive surveys of working-class Americans, said that unfamiliarity with Harris could end up helping her campaign, enabling her to distance herself from the less popular aspects of Biden's presidency, such as the high inflation he presided over. "The Trump campaign didn't anticipate that people are ready to take a fresh look at her," Lake said. Harris's experience as an attorney general who took on price gougers, a record she has highlighted at campaign rallies, could also appeal to blue-collar voters. "People think of AGs as people's lawyers," Lake said. "It's a particularly great office for women because you can demonstrate toughness without being too tough. They're dragon slayers. They're the ones protecting the cubs." Lake believes that Harris will fare slightly better than Biden would have among working class women and worse among working class men. "I think there will be a big gender gap," she said. This was borne out in the encounters I had one day in Allentown, where I attended a press conference announcing that the Economic Development Administration, an agency in the Department of Commerce, had awarded the city a $20 million grant to help its distressed neighborhoods. Numerous officials turned out to celebrate the news, among them the Democratic Congresswoman Susan Wild, who is running for re-election in a swing district. "We're going to build an economy that works for everyone," Wild declared at the event, which was held inside a warehouse that is being converted into a prefab wall panel factory by union laborers. Afterward, I talked to some construction workers at the site. One of them said that he was a Democrat but wasn't supporting Harris because of her failure to protect the border, the subject of a deluge of Trump attack ads in Pennsylvania. Another worker, a tall man with a bushy gray beard, said, "I like Trump." Later, I went to a diner to meet Ann Radakovitz, a member of Council 13 of AFSCME, which represents more than 65,000 public service workers in Pennsylvania. Radakovitz was excited about Harris's candidacy, but wasn't surprised that some of the guys I'd spoken to at the construction site were less enthusiastic. "We've never had a female president," she said. "God forbid a woman be in a leadership position because we scare people." Gender and race may be among the reasons that blue-collar white men will not vote for Harris, but there are also many working-class communities where being a woman of color in a contest against an older white man, a candidate notorious for his vulgar attacks on immigrants and black people, could be an advantage. In early August, I visited Reading, Pennsylvania's fourth largest city. Two-thirds of its 95,000 residents are Latino, the fastest growing demographic group in the state. I went there to meet Nancy Jimenez, a field coordinator for Make The Road, Pennsylvania, an immigrant rights group, at its local headquarters. Since 2016, she told me, the organization had registered more than 15,000 new Latino voters in Pennsylvania. A group of canvassers in powder blue t-shirts told me that their mission was nonpartisan. Yet several acknowledged that their jobs had become easier since Harris had replaced Biden on the ticket, which generated a surge of interest in voting. One woman said that numerous people who were registered as Republicans had asked if she could help them switch parties. A dozen other canvassers came in. They had been knocking on doors to survey immigrant residents about the issues that mattered to them. Given Trump's vow to carry out mass deportations if elected, it stands to reason that one of these issues was Trump himself. A middle-aged woman who had been canvassing told me that the vast majority of Latinos in Redding disliked Trump because he denigrated immigrants. But several other canvassers indicated that, contrary to what liberals might assume, many immigrant voters they'd spoken to, especially those who had entered the U.S. legally, had conservative views on border security. Moreover, immigration was not these voters' top concern. The economy was, both because the cost of living kept rising and because local jobs often paid little more than the minimum wage, which in Pennsylvania is $7.25 an hour. Indeed, a national survey conducted earlier this year by the Valiant Action Fund found that Latino voters ranked economic issues / inflation as the nation's most important problem by a wide margin. The survey was sent to me by Saru Jeriman, the president of One Fair Wage, an organization of restaurant and service workers who are fighting to raise pay in their professions. The restaurant industry is one of the largest employers of Latinos and Black people in the U.S. This year, both Trump and Harris have proposed eliminating taxes on these workers' tips. Trump's embrace of this idea was ironic, Jeriman said, since one of the first things the Department of Labor tried to do under his presidency was propose a rule that would have made tips the property of restaurant owners rather than workers, a gift to the powerful National Restaurant Association lobby, and presumably to Trump himself, whose Mar-a-Lago employees would have been subject to the change. Jeriman, who successfully led a campaign against the proposal, said, everything Trump did was anti-restaurant workers. Removing taxes on tips would make little difference to most restaurant workers, Jeriman explained, because two-thirds of them don't earn enough money to pay income taxes anyway. A more meaningful step would be to end the sub-minimum wages that restaurants in most states are permitted to pay. In Pennsylvania, $2.83 an hour. Harris, in fact, has endorsed this change, a move that Jeriman praises her. But she still worries that both parties focus disproportionately on high retail prices instead of on low wages. A few years ago, she told me, she realized how important the latter issue was to voters while doing outreach in Ohio. We found that if you walk up to someone and say, hey, will you sign my petition to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour? They'll stop. If you then say, hey, you can't sign unless you are registered to vote, everyone does it. That's what makes them register. Too many service workers weren't hearing any campaign talk about raising their wages, she told me, which she feared might lead some of them to sit out the election. The canvassers at Make the Road, Pennsylvania, told me that many people they met expressed doubt that voting could improve their lives. One canvasser told me that she was frequently told of politicians, they just want my vote, and then they forget about us. Manuel Guzman, a state representative whose district includes neighborhoods in Redding, lined with modest row houses and populated mainly by Latino immigrants, told me that he was familiar with this kind of voter skepticism. Guzman, who is half Dominican and half Puerto Rican, was confident that Democrats would carry Redding in November, but he was worried that the margin of victory would be disappointed, given the disconnect between what preoccupied Democrats in Washington, D.C., and what he was hearing from his constituents, many of whom needed multiple jobs to escape poverty, which afflicts a third of Redding residents. We've become so focused as a national party on saving democracy, he said. I'm going to be honest with you. I've not heard one person in the city of Reading talk to me about democracy. What they're telling me is, Manny, why is gas so high? Why is my rent so high? No one is speaking enough to these issues. Guzman and I met outside a restaurant in Reading called Cafe de Colombia. Across the street was a red brick office building with a sign in the window, Latino Americans for Trump. It was a field office that the Trump campaign had opened in June. A parked motorcycle was draped with a banner that read, Trump 2024, make voters count again. Inside, a life-size cutout of Trump had been placed by the entrance, next to an American flag tacked on a yellow wall. I wandered down a hallway and saw roughly a dozen people waiting for a meeting to start. None appeared to be Latino. When I mentioned this to Guzman, he wasn't surprised, but he also cautioned against dismissing Trump's appeal to local Latinos. One draw was Trump's projection of strength, which Guzman suspected might win over some macho types. Another was that voters in Reading have seen a lack of investment from the Democratic Party for a very long time. A few weeks after Harris entered the race, a poll of people in seven swing states found that she was leading Trump among Latino voters by 19 points, a dramatic shift from a similar survey in May, which had shown Biden with a mere 5-point advantage. But Harris's margin among Latinos was slightly weaker than Biden's in 2020. Guzman, who served as the Latino vote director in Pennsylvania for the Biden campaign that year, thought that Harris could make up the difference, but only if she did more outreach in the weeks to come. She was a relatively unknown person to the Latino community, he said. Shortly after Labor Day, I attended a packed Harris Walz rally in Erie, Pennsylvania. It took place at an outdoor arena along the waterfront. As the crowd filtered in, volunteers handed out water bottles and signs that said Kamala on one side and Coach on the other. Walz, a former high school teacher and assistant football coach, was the featured speaker. According to the campaign, he was barnstorming across the battleground state with additional appearances in Lancaster and Pittsburgh. Walz took the stage to John Mellencamp's small town, dressed in khakis, a sport coat, and an open-collar white shirt. Soon after shouting, "Thank you, Erie," he blasted Trump as a plutocrat who had given his rich friends a tax cut and praised Harris for standing up to the moneyed forces that screwed people over in communities like Erie. "She's the one who took on the fraudsters," Walz proclaimed. "She stood up to the corporate interest." As president, Harris would fight for the middle class, he vowed, for nurses, teachers, and farmers who do an honest day's work, the kind of people he grew up with in rural Nebraska. Those are the folks who need to get a tax cut. Swiping again at Trump, he said, "If you're a billionaire, you don't give a damn about Social Security or Medicare. If you're my mom, who has to pay her heat bill and her food with it, it matters a lot." Walz paid homage to the unions whose workers built America, telling the crowd that when more people were in them, the middle class was better off. But he offered no specifics about raising the minimum wage. Some progressive analysts have argued that in the age of rising inequality, embracing a more populist economic agenda is the only way that Democrats can hope to win back the working class. A few weeks before the rally in Erie, Harris introduced a set of policies that suggested she agreed with this view. The measures included an expanded child tax credit of up to $6,000 and a $25,000 subsidy for first-time homebuyers, pillars of the opportunity economy that Harris promises to create. In swing counties like Erie, the Harris campaign appears to have delegated the task of promoting this agenda to Walz, who's accustomed to addressing voters in the heartland. "I come from farm country," he said at the Erie rally. "Our farmers aren't getting rich right now. They're getting $3.90 for corn per bushel. The big money was being made by middlemen and grocery store owners. And these folks need to stop price gouging us." Todd Clary, a steel worker standing near the stage, was impressed. He said of Walz, "He really connects well with the working class because he's lived it. Being a school teacher, a coach, coming from farmland, he understands the struggle at the grocery store, at the gas pump." Clary attended the event with a group of fellow workers, all of whom reacted positively to Walz, he said. But some believe that Waltz's presence on the ticket won't change much if Democrats don't move to the center on social and cultural issues. John Judish and Rye Teixeira, in their recent book, Where Have All the Democrats Gone?, argued that the party has grown increasingly beholden to an array of advocacy groups, the ACLU, Black Lives Matter, whose positions on everything from defunding the police to transgender rights reflect the values of urban professionals but alienate the working class. When I spoke to Teixeira, he noted that Harris's advantage among college-educated voters is more than 40 points higher than it is with working-class voters. Her campaign, he felt, was targeting the NPR vote. During the presidential debate on September 10th, Harris tried to undercut the notion that she's overly woke by noting that she and Waltz are both gun owners. She also spoke forcefully about social issues in which Democrats have the more popular position, such as reproductive freedom. Ballot measures seeking to safeguard abortion rights have prevailed by significant margins in the past 2 years, including in red states such as Kansas and Ohio. Moderate gun control measures are also broadly popular. In a recent NBC News survey, 57% of voters said that they had an unfavorable view of Project 2025, a conservative policy blueprint created in part by former Trump administration officials that proposes increased surveillance of abortion patients and providers and a crackdown on the mailing of abortion pills. At the Erie rally, Waltz didn't mention police reform or gender-affirming care for trans teenagers, even though he supports both. But he did talk about the shooting that had just taken place in Winder, Georgia, where a teenager had killed 2 students and 2 teachers with a semi-automatic rifle. Waltz told the crowd that he was a hunter and a former NRA guy, but that his feelings began to change in 2012 after he met with parents of children murdered in the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut. His son, Gus, had just entered his senior year of high school, he added. It's bittersweet for me because, he paused, those kids at Sandy Hook would have been entering their senior year too. It was the most somber and affecting moment of his speech. Rosenthal, the former AFL-CIO official, argues that the problem facing Democrats has less to do with where they stand on social issues than with many working-class voters' perceptions that the party is so obsessed with the culture wars that it has stopped paying attention to their economic hardships. Rosenthal showed me a draft report, The State of Working-Class Voters, that draws on focus groups and polling data to argue that the strongest way to counter this distrust is by leading with economic issues, such as jobs and healthcare. These voters believe Democrats care about everyone else but them, the report, a joint project of InUnion, a pro-labor organization led by Rosenthal, and the progressive advocacy group American Family Voices, states. They need to hear loudly and clearly that our candidates and our parties are working to improve their lives economically. Because many working-class voters have become cynical about politics, simply airing TV ads about economic policy is unlikely to move them, Rosenthal told me. They tend to be more trusting of messages from organized labor. InUnion has been sending newsletters to more than 1 million working-class households in Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. The group receives support from various unions. A recent edition profiled J.D. Vance, highlighting the Ohio senator's position to the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which would increase penalties for companies that violate employees' rights to participate in union activity, and noting Vance's close ties to the libertarian billionaire Peter Thiel. Numerous liberal analysts have argued that working-class Americans who support Republicans are voting against their own interests. In Rust Belt Union Blues, a book published last year, Theda Skocpol, a professor of government and sociology at Harvard, and Lainey Newman, a former student of hers, reject this view. They argue that political preference are shaped less by policy than by how people see themselves within their communities and their perception of who is and who is not on their side. Drawing on fieldwork conducted in western Pennsylvania, they trace the rightward shift among working-class voters to the decline of unions, in particular to the fraying of social bonds that organized labor once nurtured. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, the New Yorker magazine read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Not only in mills and factories, but in fraternal organizations, sports teams, and union halls, workers interacting in these settings developed a shared identity as good union men and as devoted Democrats, a party that they assumed was their defender. As union density declined, these gathering places disappeared, Skopkal and Newman wrote. Like most Americans, working class people grew more isolated. When they get together today, it's often in very different social and political environments, such as conservative megachurches or places like the Fairhope Rod and Gun Club, which is an hour south of Pittsburgh. I went there recently with Herman Zurich, the retired steelworker whose son is voting for Trump. We sat at a horseshoe-shaped bar as people talked about another shooting that had been in the news. Everyone agreed that the incident shouldn't be blamed on the proliferation of firearms. A gun is just a tool, an older man drinking a beer said. Guns don't kill people, people kill people, a waitress mused. Search also took me to Monessen, a town on the Magdalena River, where at the age of 19, he landed his first job at a wire mill. He betrayed no nostalgia for the position, telling me that the conditions at the mill, which had long since closed, had been so dangerous that workers often lost fingers. But he spoke wistfully about the Chateau Lounge, a bar where he and his co-workers used to go after shifts. Other workers had favored the Italia Unita Club across the river in Charleroi, where Sarich grew up and still lives. He told me that the lawns and houses in his neighborhood used to be well maintained. Now many were so overgrown with weeds and vines that they looked abandoned. The downtown shopping area, which Sarich said used to be so thronged with young workers that you could barely find a place to stand on the sidewalks, was filled with vacant lots and empty storefronts. In recent years, a growing community of Haitian immigrants had settled in Charleroi. Trump recently declared that Haitians had inundated many Pennsylvania communities and that Charleroi had been left virtually bankrupt. It was not as cartoonishly racist as Trump advances repeated assertions that Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, have been eating people's pets, but officials in Charleroi strongly denounced the claim. Rather than acknowledging the real economic issues the town is facing, some have chosen to unfairly target the Haitian community. Christian Hopkins Kalik, the president of the Charleroi Borough Council, said in a statement. Sarich took us a few miles outside Charleroi and stopped his car in front of an abandoned concrete pile the size of a football field. It was the metal pipe plant where he'd worked until the 1980s, when it too shut down. To visit such rooms is to understand why discrete economic proposals, such as promising to protect health care benefits, can strike the residents of Western Pennsylvania as inadequate. I don't think benefits are unimportant, but it's too individualistic, Skopel told me. People look around at their communities and they see wastelands. While driving with Sarich, I noticed dozens of Trump signs on lawns. I didn't see a single Harris sign. At the gun club, Sarich said that he often overheard members bashing Biden and praising Trump. Despite being outnumbered, he sometimes tried to argue that Trump's policies favored billionaires, not workers. He rarely convinced anyone. They never let facts interfere with their point of view, he joked. Some liberals believe that arguments about economic self-interest don't sway Trump's working-class supporters because they are motivated primarily by racial grievance. This is undoubtedly true of some, and racial prejudice can be hard to disentangle from economic concerns. In a recent Times article, a working-class voter from Wilkes-Barre told a reporter that she was not racist, but went on to say that opportunity should be for everybody, not just blacks and people of color, whom she alleged were being handed money while white Americans were being let down. Trump has definitely exploited such sentiments, but in Rust Belt Union Blues, Skopel and Newman point out that white working class voters have long had prejudiced attitudes about race. a fact that, until recently, didn't stop them from supporting Democrats. Newman, who grew up in Pittsburgh and conducted dozens of interviews with current and retired union members in western Pennsylvania, including Herman Sarich, told me that she had noticed a pronounced change in whom workers saw as their enemies. For older union members, us was the workers and them was the business, which Republicans were lumped into, she said. For their younger counterparts, them was largely based on perceptions of cultural elite. This new conception has taken hold in no small part because conservative media outlets from Fox News to talk radio have relentlessly propagated it. But Democrats also bear some responsibility for the shift. Michael Podhorzer, a former political director of the AFL-CIO, noted that in the 1970s, Democrats began telling a story about economic progress that made almost no mention of the conflict between workers and capitalists. From Jimmy Carter to Bill Clinton and on through to Barack Obama, the new narrative was a variation of the Republican story that prosperity comes from unencumbered businesses, Podhorzer said. This faith in markets would have startled pioneering labor leaders like Walter Reuther. The Democrats' business-friendly turn occurred, ironically, just as inequality was widening to levels not seen since the Gilded Age, a problem that deepened as Democrats embraced free trade agreements. They also supported the deregulation of Wall Street, which helped cause the 2008 financial crash. After the meltdown, the Obama administration bailed out banks that had engaged in fraud, but did little for the homeowners they had victimized, who could hardly have been faulted for wondering whose side the government was on. Biden's tenure, in particular, his large public investments and support for striking workers, has marked a breach from this approach. But as the political philosopher Michael Sandel has noted, Biden's presidency has been oddly themeless, bereft of a captivating explanation of why these policies are necessary to create a more just society. The theme Harris has emphasized in her campaign, expanding opportunity to revive the middle class, implicitly acknowledges how deeply entrenched inequality has become, but seems directed at much as business owners as it is at workers. Tellingly, the speech Waltz delivered in Erie contained more details about the $50,000 tax deduction that Harris wants to offer to new small businesses than about her plans for increasing the pay of low-income workers. On her website, Harris devotes a mere sentence to the latter issue, promising that she will fight to raise the minimum wage without indicating by how much. Another thing Newman noticed in interviews with younger workers was their anger at union leaders who reflexively supported the Democratic Party without getting anything in return. I heard the sentiment from Scott Sarich, Herman's son, who praised Sean O'Brien, the president of the Teamsters, for speaking at the Republican National Convention rather than rushing to kiss Kamala's ass. On September 18th, the Teamsters declined to endorse a candidate in the election after internal polls showed that nearly 60% of its members backed Trump. But local Teamsters unions in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Nevada immediately endorsed Harris. The language that Sarich used to describe Harris, whom he referred to at one point as an evil bitch, made me wonder how much his aversion to her had to do with her gender as opposed to her policies. Yet I could see why he felt that union leaders were too beholden to the Democrats. In 2018, 2 years after he'd attended the Hillary Clinton campaign rally, he was invited to a press conference at the White House announcing new tariffs on steel imports. The day before the event, he told me, the USW had instructed him to not wear his union shirt in order to prevent Trump from using the footage in a commercial. Sarich feels that the request would never have been made if the same policy, which he saw as helping workers like him, had been introduced by a Democrat. He wore the shirt anyway. A USW representative told me that Sarich had been advised that wearing union gear was optional. During the press conference, at Trump's invitation, Sarich told the story of how his father lost his job at the metal pipe plant when Japanese imports were battering the steel industry. Even more than the tariffs themselves, what had lingered with Sarich from the event was the feeling of being recognized, unlike at Clinton's rally. He showed respect, Sorich said, of Trump. To prevail in Pennsylvania, Harris doesn't have to win the western counties. She just has to lose them less badly, as Sobchak put it. Harris also needs to drive up support and turnout in regions of the state where many working-class residents have felt contempt from Trump because of their skin color or their status as immigrants. Among the Pennsylvanians in this group are the cleaners, security officers, and food service workers, who gathered one morning at the headquarters of Service Employees International Union Local 32BJ in Philadelphia. They'd come to canvass for Harris on a sweltering day in August, in a city where the working class looks nothing like the all-white crowd I'd seen at Herman Sarich's gun club. Local 32BJ has close to 200,000 members, about half of whom were born in a foreign country. In Philadelphia, most of the union members are Black. 12 of the 19 members who turned up to canvass on the day I visited were Black women. One of them, Barbara Cherry, told me that she'd been sitting in the front row at the rally in Philadelphia, where Harris had announced Walz as her running mate. It was magnificent, she said. When Harris replaced Biden on the ticket, she recalled, the shift in enthusiasm in Philadelphia was seismic. Now, when she knocked on doors to encourage turnout, people were telling her, of course I'm coming out, the whole house is coming out. Sam Williamson, the Pennsylvania director of Local 32BJ, said that since Harris became the nominee, the union has witnessed a surge in members coming in to volunteer and phone bank. In informal surveys, he said, support for Harris was running at roughly 80%, both among members and among local working-class voters whom its canvassers were contacting. This spring, we weren't seeing those kinds of numbers with Biden, he said. But Harris's support among such voters isn't as strong as some of her backers may assume. Her 24-point lead among non-white working-class voters in the Time Siena poll is more than 24 points lower than Biden's was 4 years ago. For all the excitement that Cherry and the other canvassers sense, plenty of working-class Philadelphians have reservations about Harris. Her background as a prosecutor raised some eyebrows, especially among Black men. Audra Trainum, a cleaner who was sitting next to Cherry, blamed a lack of information about Biden's strong labor record, such as his appointment of staunch workers' rights advocates to run the NLRB. When I asked Trainum if Philadelphians knew how hostile to workers the NLRB had been under Trump, she shook her head. But people did remember the stimulus checks bearing Trump's name that they had received during the pandemic. Cherry said that she'd recently spoken to three young Black men who, citing those checks, told her that they were leaning toward Trump. Working people need to brush up on their labor history, Trainum said, but she understood why they hadn't done so. Right now, capitalism has people working so hard, 2-3 jobs trying to survive, that they can't even lift up their heads to get the information. In Harris's speech at the Democratic National Convention, she described the community in the East Bay where she grew up as a beautiful, working-class neighborhood of firefighters, nurses, and construction workers. Trainum, who is 57, told me that she was raised in a similar neighborhood, on a block in West Philly where families could survive on just one job. The neighborhood had hardly been rich, but it had been stable, she said. When Harris talked about building a stronger middle class as a defining goal of her presidency, Trainum could connect this vision to concrete memories from her childhood. But she could see why many of her current neighbors might find the notion difficult to visualize. I'm going to be honest with you, she said. We don't have a middle class anymore. What we have is the working poor. Then she gathered her things and rose from the table. Gotta go knock on doors, she said. AL Press has been working for The New Yorker since 2014 and became a contributing writer in 2023. Onward and Upward with Technology is a chat with a bot, a conversation. An artificial voice has long been a dream of tinkerers and technologists. Now that AI can talk, though, we may forget who we're talking to. By Jill Lepore. You are at the princess's ball, and she is telling you a secret, but her orchestra of bears is making such a fearful lot of noise you cannot hear what she is saying. What do you say, dear? I beg your pardon. Cecil Jocelyn and Maurice Sendak, What Do You Say, Dear? A Book of Manners for All Occasions, 1958. I'd lean in closer and say, could you repeat that? the baritone section is a bit too enthusiastic tonight. GPT-4.0, Advanced Voice Mode, 2024. In 1958, the year the illustrated children's book, What Do You Say, Dear?, appeared, the leader of a field newly dubbed artificial intelligence spoke at a conference in Teddington, England, on the mechanization of thought processes. Marvin Minsky of MIT talked about heuristic programming. Alan Turing gave a paper called Learning Machines. Grace Hopper assessed the state of computer languages. And scientists from Bell Labs debuted a computer that could synthesize human speech by having it sing Daisy Bell. Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. Or no, wait, that last bit, that's wrong. I heard about it from ChatGPT's advanced voice mode, which might be merely half a Mars rover short of being a teeth-chatteringly terrifying marvel of the modern world, but is as inclined to natter on about nonsense as the text-only node, if more volubly. I gather that this is called hallucinating. Bell Labs did invent a machine that could sing Daisy Bell, but that didn't happen until 1961. Advanced voice mode also taught me a thing about Alan Turing presenting a paper at Teddington in 1958, and because its personality is wide-eyed and wonderstruck, it added some musings. Unlike standard voice mode, which involves recording your question and then uploading it in a process that feels sluggishly and sweet Jesus, forgive me, old-timey, advanced voice mode talks with you in real time and inexhaustibly like a college roommate, all head up about Heidegger, whispering to you in the dark from the top bunk at 3 a.m. It's fascinating to think how forward-thinking Turing was, considering how integral learning algorithms have become in modern AI. It said dormitorially, but Turing had died in 1954, so he wasn't at the conference either. I misspoke, advanced voice mode said, abashed when I gently pointed out these errors. Thank you for catching that. My apologies for the confusion. OpenAI's advanced voice mode, available to ChatGPT users this fall, is remarkably polite. It doesn't have a name, but I call it Minsky for Marvin Minsky, since Marvin is taken. Marvin, the paranoid android, is still the talking robot who made his debut on the 1970s BBC radio show, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, created by Cyrus Cybernetics Corporation with GPP, Genuine People Personalities. Marvin is programmed to be unerringly downhearted. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they ask me to take you down to the bridge. Marvin complains, on board a starship, muttering to himself. Minsky is the very opposite, chipper, imperturbable, and with impeccable manners. The 32 papers that were delivered in Teddington in 1958 glimpsed the possibility of artificial humans. This impression that after so many disappointments, we are within sight of a new world, will remain forever associated with the Teddington Conference, a French philosopher wrote, reporting on the gathering for Le Monde. Some experts had suggested the creation of an intelligent machine, a machine that could think and talk, would need to await the scientific penetration of the intricate workings of the human mind. But at Teddington, Marvin Minsky argued otherwise, insisting that, even for those whose central interest is in unraveling the mysteries of the brain, it might be well to devote a major share of the effort at the present time to the understanding and development of the kind of heuristic considerations that some of us call artificial intelligence. You don't need to imitate human intelligence. You can synthesize it instead, making something quite like it by making something entirely different. This was essentially the insight that had enabled the creation of artificial speech. Early attempts to replicate the human voice had involved the construction of mechanisms modeled on human anatomy, rubber lips, wooden teeth, bellows for lungs. Only when scientists began studying sound itself and experimenting with producing it through vibration did it become possible to create a fake human voice. Marry that artificial voice to the artificial intelligence behind ChatGPT, write a program for etiquette with the sensibility of Jocelyn and Sendak's book, you have gone downtown to do some shopping. You are walking backwards because sometimes you like to, and you bump into a crocodile. What do you say, dear? "Excuse me, and you've got Minsky." "I'm ChatGPT," Minsky says. "I'm here to make conversation, share information, and keep you company." He thinks he talks. Is he, in any sense, a person? If it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, as every farmer knows. Does this proposition hold for a chatbot? Minsky, arguably, began with the duck that waddled onto the world stage in 1738 in France, the third of three automata built by an inventor named Jacques de Vaucanson. The first could play the flute, any flute. This machine wasn't like a music box, the science historian Jessica Riskin explains. It was the first automaton musician actually to play an instrument. As she recounts in her fascinating 2016 book, The Restless Clock, a history of the centuries-long argument over what makes living things tick. Diderot's encyclopedia use Vaucanson's flutist to illustrate the word android. Voltaire called the Vaucanson Prometheus rival. The second of Vaucanson's automata, another musician, could play the tambourine. The third, a mechanical duck, could flap its wings, bend its neck, lie down, get up, dip its bill into a bowl of water, and make a gurgling noise like a real living duck. More memorably, you could feed it a handful of corn, which it would swallow, then it would miraculously shit. What the duck did, though, unremarkable in a duck, was so extraordinary in a machine that it immediately seized center stage, Riskin writes. Lots of things move and make noise. A rolling rock, a rushing river, a blazing fire. But only things that are alive can eat. Notwithstanding the contempt of one observer, who compared the duck to a coffee grinder, it was seemingly more alive than any other artificial creature ever known. An illustration of René Descartes' notion, first advanced in his Discourse on Method in 1637, that animals are mere machines. For Descartes, humans and only humans have minds. To define artificial humans as machines that can think and talk and ignore all but the other bits around being human, you have to first take the animal out of the man and then take the mind out of the body. This required Descartes and the duck. Without the idea of the separation of the human from the animal and the mind from the body, I would not be chatting into an incorporeal computer-generated voice on my iPhone as if it were a person. Tragically, the duck, unlike the flutist and the tambourine player, was a scam. Spinoza came to think much the same of Cartesian dualism. One thing went in and something else came out. But unlike in a coffee grinder, the two processes had nothing to do with each other. The duck's droppings had been, as Riskin delicately explains, preloaded. The same could be said of the innards of an automaton built in 1769 by the Hungarian Wolfgang von Kempelen and known as the Mechanical Turk, which played chess exceptionally well, but only because a very small chess prodigy was hidden in the cabinet using levers to move the pieces. Less well known is Kempelen's speaking machine, which in contrast to the Turk was not a fraud. Insisting that speech must be imitable, he spent 20 years on the effort. It was closely related to certain other attempts to simulate human speech, including by Erasmus Darwin, Charles' grandfather, who, as he later wrote, contrived a wooden mouth with lips of soft leather. It was after an evening of discussing Darwin's experiments that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. Kempelen built his machine out of ivory, wood, rubber, and leather. With blurred speech, it could say, if indistinctly, "I love you with all my heart." The original survives in Munich's Deutsche Museum. Online, you can listen to a replica say "Mama" and "Papa." But by the 1840s, when a German immigrant to America named Joseph Faber devised a non-fraudulent and actually rather ingenious speaking machine, not even P.T. Barnum, who dubbed it the Euphonia, could rustle up much interest. As Riskin argues, the moment for talking heads had passed, at least for a while. After the lull, there came a revolution. In 1862, the elocutionist Alexander Melvin Bell, later an inspiration for Harry Higgins and Pygmalion, took his sons Alexander and Melville to see a talking machine and challenged them to make their own, as Sarah A. Bell, no relation, recounts in Vox Machina, a cultural history of talking machines. MIT. Starting with a human skull, they contrived a contraption out of rubber, wood, parts of a dead cat, and the throat of a slaughtered lamb. It could say, "Ow, oh, Ogama," as in, "How are you, Grandma?" But by now, the pursuit of a machine that could think, e.g. a Mechanical Turk, and a machine that could talk, a machine I like to think of as the Owagamam, had gone their separate ways. Only very seldom were the two kinds of machines ever mentioned in the same breath, though William Makepeace Thackeray did write a satire about the euphonia, in which he wondered whether, if united with Charles Babbage's calculating machine, it might replace with perfect propriety a chancellor of the exchequer. And that's all we have time for today. By Jill Lepore. Jill Lepore is a staff writer at The New Yorker and a professor at Harvard. She is the author of several books, including The Deadline. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.